Welcome everybody, and thank you for joining me today for SMIE Consulting's Midweek Roundup. Today we have three important issues that have come to the fore in the last few days, and it'll be an interesting ride to see and hopefully get your thoughts on what these stories mean for international educators. And certainly, I think there's a lot of interesting food for thought on what these topics mean on the future of international education. There's a couple of interesting philosophical thoughts on international education and where we're going. But certainly want to start today with the big story that broke this week on Saudi Arabia's pullout from Canada, on halting all cooperative ventures, and also this fracas has this extended into the education realm, where the nearly 7,000, right now there are nearly 7,000 Saudi Arabian students studying in Canada. This is a bit of a blow on a number of different levels for both Canada and for Saudi Arabia, certainly politically. This is a significant issue. It's interesting how this has developed. And for those of you not familiar with the news story, it's been covered in both the Chronicle and Inside Higher Ed this week. I'm posting the link now to that story in Inside Higher Ed this week in the comments section of the SMIE Consulting Facebook page. So I certainly encourage you to read that article when you have a chance, if you haven't already. But this is coming out of some remarks made by the foreign ministry in Canada on their Twitter feed, and by their foreign minister and the foreign ministry Twitter feed, related to recent imprisonment of human rights and women's rights activists in Saudi Arabia, and how Canada was calling for their release and for the situation to be resolved, and that those that are advocating for human rights and women's rights in Saudi Arabia be afforded the freedom that they deserve and not be imprisoned for speaking up for those values. And certainly the backstory here, for those who haven't been following, Saudi Arabian women were recently granted the right to drive, something that's been a long fought for for women in that country, and that has been widely greeted as a success story moving forward. Saudi Arabia, from some of the laws in that country that tend to be very repressive in Western eyes, but it also is come after that that rather success successful achievement. The brother of one of the chief advocates for this new policy allowing women to drive in Saudi Arabia, the brother had been in prison for a while for disrespecting Islam in the Saudi Arabian government's mind. Now the sister, who had been one of the chief advocates for women's driving rights in Saudi, has also been in prison, and that prompted a lot of backlash, certainly in non-governmental spheres before Canada stepped in. And you would see these kinds of things certainly when it comes to Saudi-U.S. relationships over the years. Those have been ones where the human rights issues are kind of talked about behind closed doors, never really publicly from a U.S. administrative perspective too vocally. Because of the huge connections between Saudi Arabia and the United States, militarily, diplomatically, economically, so those were never really emphasized on a public scale as perhaps as much as they needed to be. And interestingly, Canada has stepped into the void of lack of global. Global support for those that are protesting these significant laws in Saudi Arabia that they see as oppressive. So it's interesting to see what the response is. And Canada certainly seven to lose potentially 7,000 students, Saudi Arabian government scholarship students. The edict is now that they're all going to be pulled out, and homes for these 7,000 students will be found in other countries. And the article was quoting quoting where those students might end up. This is Deputy Minister of Education Jasser bin Sulaiman Al-Habrash. He gave to state-run TV in Saudi that we will be able to accommodate this number of students in excellent countries such as the United States, UK, Australia, and New Zealand. So that's 7,000 on basically on principle, being removed on principle. I don't know if that's certainly a consequence that the Saudi Arabian government saw coming. But certainly it's one that is going to leave a potentially significant impact. Right now, the numbers from coming out of Canada say that Saudi Arabians are only 2% of Canada's roughly 494,000 international students in 2017, which is quite a bit higher than the numbers, the 494,000 students is quite a bit higher than what's been reported in Project Atlas. Which had them Canada last year at 312,000. So of that nearly 500,000 students, Saudis are just 2%. So not as significant. Whereas in the United States, Saudi Arabia, they're over as of last year, 2016-17, there were 52,000 roughly international students, and that number has always been from my sources in Saudi Arabia, most likely from most specifically from Education USA, and what they've been reporting is those numbers were always undercounted in Open Doors, and that the numbers were more like 70 or 80,000 international students that they were tallying in the United States. So we obviously in the U.S. have quite a few more Saudis than Canada does, but. And percent that's both percentage-wise and number-wise than Canada did, but 7,000 students upping sticks all of a sudden can leave a big hole in those institutions. I think following some of the conversations on Twitter related to this topic from some Canadian sources, most notably Alex Usher and some of his excellent work he does north of the border in higher ed circles. Reported, I think, that some institutions like McGill in Montreal had about 350 Saudi students. So UBC, I think UBC in Vancouver was perhaps had a few more number-wise, but they certainly would. That's a huge number to fill on the eve of a new academic year starting. So it's going to be interesting to find out where those go, those 7,000 students. Go if they're going to find immediate placement in for fall terms in those other countries, or if any of that if that they're going to have to wait a year to find another place. So very unfortunate situation for those 7,000 students, obviously first and foremost, but unintended consequences perhaps, but certainly it will have potentially lasting impact between Canada and Saudi Arabia in their relationships. So I'm curious to see what might be next in line in terms of countries that might respond to that, at least publicly. And that's certainly a very bold stance that Canada has taken in defense of those that are have been imprisoned. So interesting to see where that goes. So that's one of the first topics I wanted to touch on. That's obviously a very vibrant issue in the news this week and taking a lot of ink on popular sites related to international higher ed. I want to thank Sena for joining me from the West Bank again. Good to see you online. And so we'll move now to a second topic, recalibrating value in international education. This is one of those topics that, we always when we talk about within an institutional context of what value for money is in international education, it's always based on perception of those that are potentially purchasing that education. And what we're looking at here, and this particular article came out in University World News on the 27th of July from coming from Dr. Rahul Chadha, one of the real top of the line thought leaders in international education these days and for the last few years. And he lays out the case that, as he highlighted, that there's been a lot of, in the last 20 years, there's been what he's called three waves of events, push-pull factors that have transcended the normal flow of students in the recruitment of international students, international student mobility. And he said the first wave he described as the terrorist attacks of 9/11 that resulted in stricter visa barriers to international students coming to the U.S. And that meant U.K., Australia expanded their international enrollments at the expense of the U.S. There was certainly a period of that to be the case, and the launch of regional hubs in Dubai, in Qatar, in Malaysia, branch campuses in Malaysia, so in other places. So there's that huge surge from post 9/11. Second was in 2008 with the financial crisis that affected the recession that affected most of the world, and how certain countries started focusing on reducing fees or charging fees for students, like EU countries charging students for fees outside European Economic Area. Also, growth of English language programs in Europe and Asia. We also see more countries kind of getting into the game in terms of the competition for international students. And the third wave, Dr. Chadha explains as the uncertainties triggered by what he calls the new political order, with anti-immigration rhetoric and restrictive work policies for international students coming into play, and specifically the impact of Brexit and election of President Trump in the United States. So what that has done to interest in the United States from other countries. So I think this particular wave that we're in and we're currently riding, either on top of or being buried by, depending on your perspective on what country you're in, we're seeing that students, our countries and institutions that have become reliant on, particularly institutions that have become reliant on international students at a time when, for revenue sources, at a time when competition has increased dramatically. It's changing the value proposition for students, and Dr. Chadha makes this case, that it's forcing families to take a look and say, okay, yes, the U.S. still has the best quality education in the world, but are these mitigating factors make it less desirable and less worth our investment? And that's something that I think anytime we're talking in international education circles about the value of what we do, for the students that come to our campuses and the value that they bring to our domestic students on our college campuses. I think that's something we often use as selling points to our administration about what financially these students, culturally these students are going to bring to our campus. But what we don't often do is look at it from the other way around. What value are we bringing to prospective students, international students, and their audiences? And I think that's Dr. Chadha's point here in giving institutions a chance to maybe pause and reflect on why they're doing what they're doing as it relates to international education. And this is certainly something that is a healthy thing. Every institution that is active in international education or any part of their remit as educational institutions should do from time to time as they recommit resources to different strategic priorities, is looking at examining who they are, what they do, and how they are perceived in the market. And that is something for international admissions staff, international educators, that we rarely have the time to do, but is becoming increasingly necessary, particularly for U.S. institutions, but the same rule applies for any country that's sincerely looking to recruit international students, is what are you doing right as an institution that is projecting value to a student and family overseas that might be considering you as an option. And that these are things that take the focus off the tuition dollars that those families are going to bring necessarily when they come to you. But also, it should shift the focus to what is our true value to these students in their long-term goals. Are we providing value for them? So this is something that I think is a good time for institutions to really think before the new academic year begins, with everything that's been going on, all the distractions with visa bans and all these other world issues on that are seem to be swirling around. How is this impacting what we do as institutions and how we position ourselves as institutions? I think this call to take a look again at what we consider value for money in our own eyes, and from my perspective, a U.S. institutional perspective, is that are we viewing it only through our lens, or should we be looking at value for money from a parent and student perspective on how we are value of what we do as institutions is being perceived. So for those of you who haven't seen that article in University World News that I've been referring to from Dr. Chadha, here it is now in the comments section from University World News, Recalibrating Value for Money for International Students. So that's a real kind of a thought-provoking article that Rahul came up with, and I really respect his work quite a bit in the field, and certainly look to him as kind of a bellwether of some of the macro trends that oftentimes institutions don't see or don't have time to see as they go through their day-to-day. And I think this is something for international educators, all international educators, to really stand up and have a thought about with respect to how your institution is perceived from students, from parents, from governments on the other end of the communication funnel. We have messages we try and get out to prospective students and their audiences and parents and institutional audiences overseas about what value we think we have. But are we really looking at it and have a good sense of how valued what we do is to those respective audiences? And I think this is a good time before the new year begins to examine those priorities and perhaps see if there are opportunities where these small opportunities, like the small from a macro sense in terms of what's happening with Saudi Arabia and Canada right now, if you're not already on the Saudi list, you're not going to be on the list soon enough to get these students in for fall. If you have deadlines back in the spring, you're not going to be taking these students for fall, but maybe there's openings in January if you're on the list now. But what are you potentially doing to reach out and to find those pockets, but to present your institution with value to those audiences? So that's kind of the $100 million question for any institution is, if any institution were able to find that secret sauce of how and know well how they're perceived in market, perhaps having more representatives in market, more alumni, more folks who are working for you in different markets around the world, not just an admissions rep that goes in once or twice a year to a particular country where you really can't gauge long-term effectiveness and value just from those visits. How you are perceived in the market goes well beyond just those short visits. And what are institutions doing to really get that market intel, to get that kind of pulse of the street in their main markets for how their value is being perceived compared to other countries and other institutions? And I think that's, as I've talked about in previous segments here, that reliance on not just how we're doing against our competitors here in the United States for students, but how we're doing against other countries and how we are positioned as an institution against other countries. I think that is something that's a next level for most international offices to get to in terms of the research they're doing to support their overall planning. So that's kind of a good food for thought article I thought I'd bring up. Another one that I also just saw late last week, in fact, right after this session broke last Wednesday, was an article out of the UK from The Guardian called "Let's Celebrate, Not Fear: The Growing Competition for Overseas Students." And I think this one was particularly interesting because it gave, I'll post it now, the link to it's now in the comments section. It really gave a good insight into the what's happening in the UK now with regard to kind of their reaction to the story that broke a few weeks ago about the UK now being number two, getting surpassed by Australia as the number two destination. The article itself really calls on UK higher ed to rally around what the UK has been doing on a positive scale through the British Council and their Study UK, Discover U campaign, what successes that British universities have had to raise undergraduate places and student visas. They've seen some increases there. But really, it's the article was written by someone in the UK, Michael Peake. He's the head of higher education systems research at the British Council, that was really calling on the UK to really look at looking at why other countries have emerged as attractive study destinations, but also looking more at how we're, the their country, the UK, is positioning themselves as an attractive package, and whether they're an attractive package to prospective students. And that call is for that it be that ultimately every country wants the incoming students from abroad to see their countries as positive, safe, and healthy, in addition to having quality instruction at their institutions and experiences there. The broader picture of ensuring a positive, safe, healthy environment for any visitor to, particularly study visitors to their countries, should be the priority. So, but I think the title of the article is "Let It This Be a Celebration," that there are more country options for students who want to study outside their home country. I think that's the point of the article, is really to get the UK institutions and kind of generate momentum for country as a whole to present a positive, safe, healthy environment for prospective students coming to the United States, because that's exactly what other countries have done with the hubs that they've established, these education cities in different countries, the language, as the second wave Dr. Chowda had talked about in the post-recession era, from 2008, was the rise of English language programs in a number of other countries in Europe and Asia, and how that attracts the kind of in England, since English is the predominant language in higher ed circles around the world, that those kinds of programs gain notoriety and other options that were cheaper, closer to home, and perhaps considered safer destinations became more popular. So what are institutions doing in this new phase to react to that and to see what might be a possible option to position their institutions for success long term? And I think from my perspective, this is where kind of the rubber hits the road for US institutions, is are you doing enough to, in your messaging, to not only show the value that we talked about earlier, to find those opportunities and be able to react quickly enough to opportunities as they come, to raise your institution's profile in certain circles, to bring more students in from particular, based on particular circumstances, like what's happening in Canada now with the Saudi Arabian students leaving there. What are you doing to assess how you're perceived out in the market? Be interested to hear from those of you who are either watching this live or who get a chance to watch this later, what your thoughts are in terms of where is the biggest missed opportunity for international for U.S. institutions that are looking at recruiting international students in your market. What is the one thing you see institutions not doing that they really should be doing in this regard, as in terms of seeing institutions, seeing themselves as providing value and communicating that message effectively to audiences that might be coming at them at a very different level from where the institution might be, in terms of where they position their own value compared to their competitors. How do the parents and students consider themselves as it relates to that university, and where's their idea of what the value of that institution is? So I think that's something that's I'd really be interested to find out where the biggest disconnect is in your perspective from an overseas point of view or from an institutional point of view, based on what you've seen in conversations you've had with parents or other agents in country, other recruitment partners you're working with. Certainly there's a lot of information that comes out in various research and studies that are done, either in surveys that come out fairly regularly, that give you some sense of where your audience might, as an institution, where your audience might be on certain topics related to value, but what their concerns are about. And the real disconnect is, I think, where institutions are talking at one level and students and parents are expecting information at a different level or on different topics. That's where I think institutions don't spend enough time knowing their individual markets and knowing the perceptions and the needs of students and parents in those markets. Those institutions that do are the ones that are really putting themselves ahead of the game in terms of what to expect. So I really think what value for money means for you as an individual institution will change, may change from year to year, but at some institutions you see like Eastern Michigan University, prominent in the You Are Welcome Here campaign in the United States, but they have also recently indicated they're for international undergraduate students, they're going to be charged now the same as in-state students from Michigan to that institution, and that's a 60% reduction in the price that they're charged. That's coming in the form of scholarships that they're packaging for international students as part of the You Are Welcome Here campaign. So that's certainly a way to recalibrate what your value actually is, a significant reduction in cost to those students and families for undergraduate studies at Eastern Michigan. So kudos to the folks up at Eastern Michigan for doing that as a way to reposition yourself in a very increasingly competitive global market. So good luck to all of you out there on the institutional side, and to my colleagues overseas who have their fingers on the pulse of what's happening in their countries. I'd welcome your comments after the session to let me know where you are on this topic, on value for education in the United States and any other country, frankly. So thanks again for joining me today, and look forward to seeing you again next week. Bye-bye.